better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to tell you, if you were at the Sebastopol Farmers Market today, I have a surprise for you towards the end of this show, and I'll talk just a little bit about it. It was an absolutely wonderful day, but we're going to go to our guest because he is chock full of information. It's Jeff Kruth, who is returning. He is the sommelier of a farmhouse inn and the only master sommelier in Sonoma County. And we'll be talking about just what that means and how hard or how easy it is to become that. And in preparation for tonight's show, I went to the website, and it's a good website. It's pretty informative, and they have the different courses that you have to take. And so I just scanned real quickly the introductory course, and to scan quickly, it's like, hey, where's California wines? And you look down, and you get down to almost the end, and there is no mention of California. It just says North American wines. So if you've been feeling like here in wine country, you're at the center of the universe, this is humbling information. It was tempered a little bit. I was reading information for the advanced course, and it says, if you read this, you can recite from memory facts such as Grand Crus of the Côte de Nuit, the satellites of Saint-Emilion, the districts of Chianti, the AVAs of Sonoma County. And I thought, okay, we are at least somewhat as important as we think we are. And on that note, Jeff, welcome back to Mouthful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. We're definitely on the map.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to go through this program?
I took the first level of the Master Sommelier, the introductory course, about 6 years ago. And I was pretty well on my way in my career and studying at that point. But between the time when I took the first exam and I passed the master's exam was about 6 years.
6 years. And why did you do it?
It was a few things. It's obviously there's a challenge of it, and I was interested in that. But it's a great way to push yourself to learn more than you naturally would. Because in your day-to-day job as a sommelier, you're studying the wines that you sell, that you're interested in. But the Master Sommelier program really focuses on the entire world of wine, and you're really held accountable to know everything about wine all over the world. And it turns you on to styles of wine and regions of the world which you would never otherwise think of. And in that process, it exposes you to things that are very exciting that I would have never personally come to if I hadn't been pushing myself and studying for the Master Sommelier.
And I do want to tell our listeners that a little bit later, we will take your questions, should you have any. So if there are obscure regions, varietals you've never heard of, except in passing, and you don't know even if they're red or white, if you have some questions for Jeff, note those down. We're not going to take calls now. I'll give you the phone number when we will. Mouthful doesn't take calls real often, but I think you're such a great resource, it'll be a nice thing to do.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it should be fun. We got smart listeners here on Mouthful. The classes that you take, are they in... Do you actually go somewhere to take them?
Yes. So each level is a little different. The introductory class is actually a class. It's a two-day-long class, and anybody can sign up to take the introductory class. We recommend that people have some background in wine, but there's no prerequisite for taking the introductory mm-hmm. class. And there is a short exam at the end of the class, which is a multiple-choice exam. But that really exposes people to what the Corps de Master Sommeliers is about and teaches people the basics of wine regions, wine styles, winemaking all around the world. The second level is actually just an exam. That's the certified sommelier. And that's a newer part of the course because there is such a huge leap in between the beginning level and the advanced level that they introduce the certified, mm-hmm. which allows the examiners to see sommeliers' service skills to actually have a tasting exam as well as a theory exam. Mm-hmm. So that's just a one-day-long exam, mm-hmm. and that is what gives you the ability to call yourself a certified sommelier.
No. When you say service skills, do you actually make a presentation?
Absolutely. It may be opening champagne or decanting a bottle of wine, but there is a service as part of that exam. It is certainly not as difficult or in-depth as the later exams, but you do actually have to do service for the masters, mm-hmm. and they grade you based on your service skills. The advanced exam goes back to a class. It's a week-long class, and then there are 3 days of examinations on the three different subject points, one being service, one being theory, which is a written exam, and then there is a tasting exam. And in that tasting exam, you have 25 minutes to identify 6 blind wines. Can be from anywhere in the world, vintage, varietal, sub-region, grape varieties, etc. And you have to build your case as to why you're saying the wines are what they are and conclude where the wines are from, what the wines are.
Do you have to do it not just varietal, but specific winery?
Winery is not an issue because,
okay.
but
region,
sub-region, grape varietal, vintage.
Uh-huh. Maybe vintage as well.
Vintage, and maybe something of the quality level of the wine.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly can't know all of the producers
sure.
in every region, so I don't think that's a...
Only Peter Whimsey.
Yes. I think that's not really a fair judge of uh-huh. somebody's tasting abilities.
I'm glad to hear that, yeah.
That is the format of the advanced exam, and that is by application, that's a really high-level, serious exam.
Mm-hmm.
The master's exam is by invitation only, happens once a year, and we repeat the same three parts, which is a tasting exam, a service exam, and a theoretical exam.
Wait, I'm confused. You have the advanced exam and then another?
Master's
exam. And then
exam.
Another. So
right.
You're not a master once you pass the advanced exam.
No,
Oh.
No, that's the...
another hoop.
Another hoop. Yeah, absolutely. The advanced exam is extremely difficult. The master's exam pushes it up quite a notch further. It's the same format, but the scoring is tougher. You have to have a much higher percentage of score, and the difficulty of the wines, the difficulty of the questions, and what you might encounter in a service exam becomes much more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a notoriously difficult exam.
Now, do you find out how you did, other than pass or fail?
There is feedback that the masters give you to encourage you, help you, and where you might need to study further. You don't get a grade or a score.
Did you find out what the wines were so you know if you were right or not?
No, they never disclose what the wines are.
Oh, that would drive me insane.
But I have a pretty good idea
yeah.
What the wines are. And if you passed, then you were certainly on the right track.
Uh-huh.
But the wines are not disclosed for some obvious reasons. They don't want to, if you're using a specific winery's wine,
sure.
then that's confidential. So
mm-hmm.
those are never mm-hmm. told, but I have a pretty good idea what the wines were.
Mm-hmm. Now, the exam this time, you passed in February, right?
I passed in February. I passed the tasting portion, which is my last portion. I had
uh-huh.
previously passed the theory and the service exam in the year before.
Oh, really? Oh, so, okay. And this time it took place in Healdsburg, right?
First time ever, as far as I know. It was held in Healdsburg, which was exciting.
Whereabouts?
It was actually at the hotel and the restaurant for Dry Creek Kitchen
Dry Creek,
the Hotel Healdsburg.
Uh-huh.
And it was a wonderful spot. It was great both to pass on my own hometown
yes.
was
yeah,
pretty
that's
neat.
Really
being
nice.
The first Sonoma County person, Master Sommelier, but to have that in a hometown. that was great. And it was, you know, we got to get out of San Francisco, and I think the students who are prospective master sommeliers really enjoyed having the exam up here.
Now, not everyone passes.
It is a very difficult exam.
Yeah, it says here.
About 10% is the pass rate for the master's exam. These are all top people. Once you get to that level of the master's exam, you are really up there as a very good sommelier. But it is an incredibly difficult exam, and the pass rate tends to be about 10%. And we have had the first master sommeliers pass the exam in 1969. There were three. They were British, because the organization started in England, was spun out of the Institute of Masters of Wine, which is another title. You'll see both Masters of Wine and Master Sommelier.
I was going to ask you to explain those two things.
The Masters of Wine has been it's a very academic approach, and much more importance on writing skills, and the exam is all done through writing. So many wine writers aspire towards the Master of Wine. Mm-hmm. And the Masters of Wine felt that there really should be a title that was based on service and for the hospitality industry. So I believe the first Master Sommeliers, the examining body, were Masters of Wine. And then the Court of Master Sommeliers was actually formed officially in 1977, and now acts as an examining body. And there has been about 150 or so people who have been given the Master Sommelier title in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And it is an international title. There are people from all over the world.
So it's 150 from all over the world.
Yeah. I think the exact number is 158. Mm-hmm. I know some of those are no longer with us, but all of the people who have ever passed are listed on the website, and I think that's it's north of 150 now.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how that breaks down when it comes to gender?
I believe there is between 15 and 20 women of the group. Mm-hmm. I don't know the exact number, but I think it's north of 15.
Mm-hmm. So 10%, a little more than 10%.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And more so in recent years, I believe we had this year along with me Emily Wines, who's another Bay Area from San Francisco. She passed on her first attempt.
She's got the name, doesn't she?
Yeah, great name. but she passed on her first attempt, which only a handful of people have ever done.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think? Do you think it's been the nature of the wine industry and the service industry that it's more weighted heavily towards men? Or do you think there's something about the competitive spirit, or is there something about it essentially that attracts more men?
I think that's changing, and women have done extremely well in the exams, I think
women have very good palates. I would think that the lack of women would just have to do more with the attraction of the career. At a certain point, rather than the inability to pass.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure exactly why the breakdown is what it is, but certainly there's lots of opportunity for anybody to succeed in the program, and I think it's great that is increasing within mm-hmm. the court.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. When I first heard about the difference in tasting abilities and taste buds between men and women, I just found that fascinating.
Yeah.
And it just takes me back to, you're out living in a cave, rearing the young. You got to make sure they don't eat any alkaloids. Babies don't eat anything that'll kill them.
Yeah.
So I like that sort of thing. Let's talk about some specific wines. Let's not. Let's talk about what you do professionally now.
Sure. So I'm the wine director for the Farmhouse Inn and Restaurant. We're in Forestville, out River Road, and I am there often in the restaurant on the floor helping guests with wine selections. And then now I also do a good bit of teaching for the court, and I've been spending a lot of time recently teaching the level one courses, doing one tomorrow out in CIA in Napa. I just did a couple others last week, so that's been a lot of fun. So those are really my main focuses is the farmhouse. We have a really exciting wine program and great food to go along with it. So that's my main focus, but teaching has become more important now that I've passed the exam.
You're listening to Mouthful. My guest this evening, Jeff Kruth of the Farmhouse Inn. I say W-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-J-E-L-
open up the door. I say, please, 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 give me some more. White pony lemon juice. White pony lemon juice. White pony lemon juice. What it do to you? You take the bottle, you take the can, you shake it up fine, you get a good, good wine. White pony lemon.
Yep. In case you're wondering, that was Frank Zappa doing that old song, White Port and Lemon Juice. And White Port isn't just the thing that's on the bottom shelf for $1.89, is it?
No, they do actually make White Port in Portugal in the Douro.
Yeah.
We don't see very much of it.
I don't think I've ever seen it here. I had it there a couple of years ago. So I'm going to give you the phone number now. If you have a question, we're going to start geeking out here talking about wine, specific varietals and that sort of thing, and you are welcome to join us. If you're listening online, don't forget to add the area code. It's 707-584-2020. If you're in Sonoma County, you know you don't need to add the 707. So you got a wine question? What? Oh, no, I gave you the wrong number. No one told me.
Was that your home number?
No, it's the number that if you just want to call directly and, you know, if you want to call and request a song, it's a different number. So, here we go. 707-588-0637. 588-0637. Mouthfuls producer Kainoa will take your call and switch you into the studio. So, it seems to me like the major, what we'll call the major varietals, the French varietals, still sort of dominate people's, the general person's conversation. Chardonnay,
Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon,
Merlot,
Sauvignon Blanc, yeah.
And then we add, in California, we add Zinfandel.
Yep.
And that just dominates, but when you get outside of there...
Yeah, when you think about it, Italy has, I think, over 2,000 indigenous grape varietals just in Italy alone. So there's so much diversity out there. But since the United States and America, we tend to market our wines based on varietal. Once you have a brand built around a varietal like Pinot Noir, it's a lot of risk for a producer to try to sell a varietal that people have never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly great Pinot Noir, but unfortunately it limits the diversity in that approach, because I think there's many grapes that would do wonderfully in California. We have almost more Mediterranean climate. If you think of all of the great grapes of the Mediterranean, it would be fascinating to see how they would grow here. But it certainly would be a marketing challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, name some of those grapes.
Oh, there's so many. But if you think of our climate in the south of Italy, if you think of where Zinfandel's predecessors may come from, you could look at grapes like Nero d'Avola of Aglianico for red grapes, white grapes, Caricante or Vermentino or many of the grapes.
Caricante, there's one I don't know.
Yeah, that's a grape that you see in Sicily, there's certainly not a lot of it. But just it would be fascinating to see how some of these little bit warmer climate grapes of the Mediterranean would do in
Grillo
California.
Grillo would be one, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I enjoyed Grillo, a white, when I was in Sicily.
Sicily and Sardinian wines and a lot of those southern Italian wines, the increase in quality in the last few years has been amazing. And while there has been certainly a legacy of kind of everyday Plonk, there are some outstanding wines being made and many, many grapes that you've never heard of some that people may have. But great Verdicchio from the Marche in Italy can be fascinating wines.
Tell us about that.
Oh, just a crisp, real, can be a mineral-laden wine, great with food, medium body, very Italian-style white wine. Some producers do them with a little bit of new oak, but most of them are just unoaked, crisp, refreshing, great food wines. And those are every village in all parts of Italy have their own unique grape varietals. I find some of the northern Italian wines fascinating. You know, regions like the Val d'Aosta, up near the Swiss border. Mm-hmm. You almost never see those wines in the United States, but wonderful wines.
Now, if you wanted to find some of those wines, let's say you want to research that, what's the best way to do it? go to a wine shop and start talking to somebody?
Absolutely. If you can find a wine shop that you can repeatedly go to, find somebody that you trust, that you know has a good palate and understanding of wine, and they can learn what you like, and then you can go back again and again and get recommendations and say, well, you know, right now I really want to explore German wine or Greek wine. And if you can find somebody you can trust both in a restaurant setting and in a retail setting, and feel free to tell them what your budget is, what you've liked, what you haven't liked, and keep going back to those people that you trust. And we have some very good places in the Bay Area.
Yeah, and I have people that I do that with. I don't want to push one over the other in this context, but I certainly have those people that I trust, and they know my palate. And that's a great thing. And also that's a draw to a restaurant, is when you know that you have someone that knows your palate and is going to say, I want you to drink this tonight.
Absolutely. When I start out with customers, sometimes I will recommend wines that are a little safer, if I don't know them, something I think they're pretty likely to like. Mm-hmm. And as I have people that come back many, many times, then I can get a little bit more adventurous. I know what they like, and I'm more willing to go out on a limb with some more unique styles of wine. So my repeat customers are a lot of fun.
If you want to tell us what you like and have Jeff recommend something that might be off your beaten path, give us a call. 588-0637 is the number. What do you do about a table that everybody orders something really different? You got a vegetarian, you got somebody eating fish, you got somebody eating, you know, braised lamb shanks. And they think, I know people, I think, going out to dinner, they still think bottle.
Yeah. Well, I love bottles of wine. I love having a bottle on the table. There's a few different things you can do. Obviously, a wine pairing. We offer wine pairings that we can pair a wine based on the dish that you're having. Also, half bottles are great in restaurants. Sometimes I'll have a couple in, and they both like different styles of wine or having different foods, so they each can get a half bottle of wine and compare. But also, if you go out with friends, I love going out with more than, you know, one person, and then you can get a couple bottles of wine. But that being said, there's also styles of wine which tend to go with many different foods. And so I try to recommend styles great locally. You know, Pinot Noir is a varietal that tends to work well both with lighter dishes, fish, but also can stand up to a little fuller-bodied foods. Mm-hmm. Certainly some fuller white wines or white wines with good acidity can be extremely food-friendly. So I try, in that situation, if they just want one bottle, to rule out the extremes on either end, that's going to clash. If you take a tannic red wine, which could be great with your steak, that may clash with the oils that are in the fish.
You don't want to force a 16% Zinfandel on the fish eater at that point.
No. But there's certainly some styles of wine which are very flexible with many different foods.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, one rule of thumb for people is if you look to where a food originates from or style of cooking, and then you drink a wine from that region, from that part of the world, they almost always go because they evolve together.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Really good point. The foods and wines of a region, they just make sense in your mouth.
Yeah.
Make sense together.
If you think of hundreds of years of evolution and thousands of years in some parts of the world, the styles of those wines and the styles of those cuisines, you know, they came into existence, together.
The number to call, 588-0637. Any question that you might have about wine. I'm going to ask a couple of the questions that I never really know the exact answer to myself. What do you do when you find out your server is an idiot about wine? You know, and I don't mean, if you go to a pizza parlor, you don't expect details. But if you go to a restaurant and you can tell, like, two sentences into the conversation that they don't know what they're talking about, what's the best way to handle that?
Well, I think there's a few ways to approach that. One, many restaurants may have somebody else, a manager or in some cases a sommelier. I think certainly feel free to ask for that person if the restaurant does have someone on staff, and that's one of the importances of reasons why it's so important to have somebody who's knowledgeable about wine. But if you're in a situation where that's just not possible, I think just ask them, what do you like? Because if you have a more complex wine list than somebody's familiar with, maybe they have a tendency to make it up a little here, but if you just ask them what they've had and what they've enjoyed personally, that may give you a little bit of information.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I'm a big fan of restaurants that know the wines they're serving.
Sure. Sure, but every now and then it's like, oh, they have no idea.
Yeah, and that's certainly you can always go back to wines you've had before.
Wines you're familiar with.
Yeah, and look for new experiences in a place where you know you're going to get proper guidance because, mm-hmm. you know, I have many wines on my wine list that I believe in fully and are outstanding wines, some of my favorite wines in the world, but I know not everybody's going to like.
Sure.
And so it's my job to try to, in a very quick period of time, read what somebody's most likely to like and recommend something based on what I can gather from their taste.
Mm-hmm. And then that other pesky question, not liking something versus this wine is bad, this wine is corked. For the Nava, a lot of people just, they aren't going to necessarily know the difference.
Or are embarrassed to say so.
Yes.
And it's very common, and that's why I taste every single bottle that's open in the mm-hmm. restaurant. And not every restaurant has that philosophy, but we have a small restaurant, and so I taste every bottle that's open. Mm-hmm. And if a wine is corked or oxidized or just past its prime, it never makes it to the table.
Mm-hmm.
But feel free to send a wine back. Restaurants do have a higher markup on wines than they do if you went into a retail store, and that is totally justified. But one of the things that comes along with that is when you go in a restaurant, the restaurant wants you to walk out happy. And so most good restaurants would much rather that they take the wine back and replace the wine with another wine if you think that there's anything wrong with it or if you're unhappy with it. Mm-hmm. And in the end of the day, what we do is about service, and we want people walking out of the mm-hmm. restaurant having enjoyed what they've had.
So if you don't want to drink that wine that someone has just
said,
you know, you should feel fine about saying it. And you don't really have to give an explanation. You don't have to prove your credentials that you even know what corked means.
For me, it's a restaurant's job to make their customers happy.
That's such a good attitude.
Yeah. So, you know, that being said, you know, certainly if a waiter or somebody says, you know, just so you know, this wine is sweet. Okay, great. Then I wouldn't send it back because you found out it's sweet.
It's sweet, yeah. Listen to your server,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so have an open and honest dialogue. Sometimes mm-hmm. we go into a restaurant and we're afraid that if we ask questions that means that we don't know something about wine mm-hmm. or we're, you know, we don't know as much as we should. You can't know everything about wine. I know an awful lot about wine, but I ask a lot of questions because mm-hmm. you can't know every wine, and I like to... A sommelier knows the food in their restaurant. They know the bottles in their restaurant, the particular vintages, how they're drinking right now. So don't be afraid to engage, and those are the customers that I find have the best time and the best experiences that basically say, hey, this is what I like, this is what I'm looking for. Even feel free to give a budget, and that really gives me a lot of room to find the best wine.
Yeah, you want to give person the information so they can make you happy.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. If you go into a doctor's office or another professional, you really go in with the expectation that you're asking them for advice and you're gonna take that seriously. But mm-hmm. that doesn't always happen in a wine setting because sometimes we think we have to know more.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison, I think. You're listening to Mouthful. If you want to join the conversation, it's 588-0637.
Down in New Orleans where everything is fine, all them cats is drinking that wine, drinking that mess, their delight. When it gets drunk, start singing all night, drinking wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
pass that bottle to me. Drinking that mess, their delight. When it gets drunk, start fighting all night, knocking down the windows and tearing out doors, drinking half a gallon and calling for more. Drinking wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
wine, spoodie-oodie, drink wine,
mop, mop,
pass that bottle to me. Hoy, hoy, hoy.
Wine, wine, wine.
Elderberry.
Wine, wine, wine.
Or cherry.
Wine, wine, wine.
Blackberry.
Wine.
Jeff Kruth, Master Sommelier and Director of Wine at the Farmhouse Inn in Forestville. If you haven't been, you should go. It's definitely one of the top special occasion places in the Bay Area. Really, absolutely lovely place. We've had some heat waves.
Yeah, a few.
Make some recommendations for hot weather drinking.
Well, definitely. I love rosé when it gets hot, and you know, sometimes people be surprised to hear that, and you think of rosé as being this kind of off dry sweet thing like White Zinfandel, but rosés can be just marvelous wines in the summertime, and you know, can be done in a dry style, and we do some very nice local rosés.
Absolutely,
from Pinot Noir, from Grenache, and then also certainly the classic rosés from southern France.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something I love in the summertime. I actually like light-bodied reds, very light, mm-hmm. pale reds that you can drink with a little bit of chill.
Right, you should chill them down.
Yeah,
don't be afraid to chill a red wine.
Right now we've been drinking a kind of obscure Italian wine called Grignolino, very light-bodied red wine, pale in color. You know, Gamay is certainly another category of wine that mm-hmm. you can chill and drink.
Yeah, there's that restaurant in New York, Steak Frites.
Mm.
One of the things I love about Steak Frites is if it's hot, you go to Steak Frites, which is off Union Square, and you know you don't have to ask them to put a bottle of Beaujolais in the fridge for you because they already have their Beaujolais in the fridge.
A lot of my customers are surprised when the bottle of red comes out because all of our wines are at cellar temperature.
Yes.
And so the wine is served at 60 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for a bigger red wine, it may be best to wait a good 5 minutes or so to mm-hmm. come up to temperature. But I like wines, red wines with a little chill. I find for the most part, from my taste, most people drink their red wines too warm.
Mm-hmm.
And their white wine's too cold. And it's a big problem also when sometimes people will bring wine into the restaurant. It's been in their car, they've been in tasting rooms, and it comes in and the wine is 80 degrees, and wine loses a lot of its character if it's exposed to heat. That can be a real problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly regional white wines from all around the world. I tend to drink more whites, light reds, and rosés mm-hmm. in the hot part of the summer, and save the Nebbiolo and Syrah and a real full-bodied reds for the winter. But mm-hmm. depends what you're eating.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I've always thought that there is a lot of room to turn dry rosés into the wine to drink in Hawaii. You go to Hawaii, and I drink beer in Hawaii mostly, but you go to Hawaii, and especially if you're anywhere near tourists, oaked Chardonnay and Cabernet.
Yeah.
It's like, anyone notice the temperature?
Yeah. Oh, no.
And dry rosé is just perfect.
Dry
rosé
or German Riesling or
yes.
you know, lighter yeah. styles of wine uh-huh. that are refreshing and that uh-huh. match the style of the texture and the weight of the food.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're having lighter fare and fresh seafood, those lighter style wines, to me, is what best complements those dishes.
Hawaiian poke, traditional Hawaiian poke, not much to it. Dry rosé. It's a
Absolutely.
Beautiful match.
And you could even do it with a spicy poke, even with a little bit of perceived sweetness. One thing that's fun in wine pairing, I like to match color sometimes. If you think of the pinkness in really fresh
mm-hmm.
tuna and the pink in a rosé, it sounds superfluous, but really when you have a match of in so many dimensions, both flavor, body, color, you really can find a perfect match.
Now you're bringing up a point that I find really interesting. You hear a lot of people who are not involved in wine at all, people, you know, sort of the ones who like to diss things, say, oh yeah, you know, you put all that wine, you taste it all blind, you can't tell if it's red or if it's white. I don't agree with that. What do you think?
No, I certainly don't agree with that. But
I think you can absolutely perceive color.
Not only can you perceive color, you can perceive varietal, and you can perceive mm-hmm. soil. You can perceive climate. Mm-hmm. But the different soil structure of the world give different character to the wines.
Mm-hmm.
But red wines and white wines are made in a different manner, and that is that red wines are used are fermented with the grape skins. Or at least allowed to extract color mm-hmm. from the grape skins. And white wines are not. The juice of a grape is actually clear in almost all cases. There's a couple of exceptions to that, but all of the varietals we commonly have, say Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, mm-hmm. Pinot Noir, the juice is clear. The color's coming from the skins. And in that skin is commonly a substance called tannin. And you can easily perceive that kind of drying sensation in your mouth that comes from tannin. And that could be one of the easiest ways to tell the difference between a red and a mm-hmm. white wine because very few white wines have tannin.
Right, yes, absolutely. Right there. The number 588-0637. If you have any question, there's no dumb question when it comes to anything, really. If there's something you want to know, you can ask it on Mouthful. Something I want to know. What is the reason? What is a legitimate reason to bring a bottle of wine into a restaurant?
I think the best reason to bring a bottle of wine into a restaurant is if this specific bottle has an emotional meaning that is beyond what the restaurant can provide. So, for example, I've had somebody call me that comes into the restaurant a lot and buys a lot of wine and says, you know, we want a wine from our anniversary vintage, and it was an off vintage, and I don't think you'd probably have anything from that vintage, do you? And I said, no, I don't. Please bring something in. Mm-hmm. So if a wine has special meaning to you, then I think that is why I would bring a wine into a restaurant. Otherwise, when I go out to restaurants, I tend to look for new experiences and look for what that restaurant is providing. And, you know, to me, it would be like bringing in my own ingredients or my own tablecloth. But that's not really the culture we have locally. We have a lot of people that love to bring their own wine in because we have so much great local wine. And we, of course, allow people to do that.
Yeah, I guess like if you've made the wine yourself, it's, you know, there's another reason to bring. I mean, and I don't mean home winemaker, but, you know.
Well, for me, you know, if I was making a wine, I could drink it at home for free. So, I think it's important to try your competitors and
there's
to know,
that's a good point.
Not to develop a cellar palate, but to know, you know, what does your grape taste like in other parts of the world? What is
that's a really, really great point.
Yeah. So I'm all for, you know, new experiences and learning new things, but there are certainly occasions where we would encourage that.
Mm-hmm. Some of the other things that you have to know about, it's not just wine and the service of wine, beer production, cider and perry production.
Spirits, cocktails, cigars.
Cigars.
Yeah.
That one, it's like, really?
Well, this is the Master Sommelier is an internationally recognized title, and cigar is not a part of most of our eating culture, but it is in other places in the world. And if your name is going to say Master Sommelier, you should be able to walk into any restaurant, in a top restaurant anywhere in the world, and provide all of the service that would be necessary.
Okay.
And there are restaurants in places of the world where cigar service would be part of that service. So that's why that would be included. But certainly cocktails, that's another great thing in the summer. I love a good cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
Sommelier is really a beverage service. Mm-hmm. And so whether that's bottled waters or sake or anything from the world of beverage, I think the sommelier should be adept at serving and selling those items.
Since you mentioned cocktails, what do you think about the new absinthe?
I've only had it once, actually. I tasted it at the bar over at Cyrus, and it seemed very typical. And put it with a little bit of water. I like it with a little bit of water.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like that real licorice-y character, it's interesting.
And was that the Hangar One, the one made domestically?
Yeah, yeah.
We're trying to get
Bay,
them on the in Alameda.
Yeah.
We're trying to get them on the air.
Yeah. It's if you really like those licorice-y flavors, that can be great. Otherwise, types of pastis, things like Pernod.
Mm-hmm.
I love that in the hot hot day.
Uh-huh.
Mix in some water and ice, and they're very refreshing.
Okay, so we do have a call, but they don't want to go on the air. So we've got the question written down here.
So Northern Italian Sparkling Red. Where do you find this? I don't know if I understand the last.
They didn't want to go on the air, but they want to know where to get Northern Italian Sparkling.
Yeah, Frizzante wines. You know, if you locally here, I would try Traversos and Bottle Barn, and you can certainly get a couple of different styles of Northern Italian sparklings. You know, if you're eating up at Santi, they do the platters of meats and cheeses.
Yeah, the charcuterie platter.
And sparkling
no,
reds.
No, the salumi. I'm sorry, Italian.
It's a great match for a little bit drier Frizzante, light-bodied sparkling reds.
Uh-huh. Now, you know who else is a real fan of that wine is Scott at Cyrus.
Yeah.
A year ago, I guess it was in December, in the winter issue of Savor Magazine last year, I did a story on red sparklers, and he was developing a new drink based on the Italian red sparkling.
Yeah, great as an aperitif, but I love it with those salty meats.
Yes.
It's one of those, you might not think of that as a pairing, but that is what those wines are classically used for, things like even like Brachetto in Piedmont. They're great with salumi and those platters.
The little bubbles on your palate, it's wonderful with those cured meats. It just... it's like little stars bursting through the fat. It's a wonderful conversation. See, if you have a question, you don't even have to go on the air. Kainoa will bring it to us. 588-0637 is the number. What's the deal with high alcohol in California? Are they going to stop?
There is definitely, I would say, at least partially a trend going the other way.
Good.
And there's a couple different, there's some good and some bad. But basically what's happened is people have waited to pick later. They're picking grapes mm-hmm. later. And grapes become riper as they hang on the vine. And ripeness means more sugar. In the process of winemaking, the yeast eat the sugar and create alcohol. And so the higher the sugar content, the more potential alcohol there is in the wine. So as people pick later, they tend to make higher alcohol wines. And the reason is that a lot of wine critics have promoted these ripe, rich flavors. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, depends on your taste. But since those wines that have been picked later that have riper flavors tend to get higher scores in magazines, because when you taste them on their own without the presence of food and in the presence of many other wines, they stand out.
They stand out, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a trend for some producers that are picking earlier, making a little leaner, lighter style, lower alcohol that mm-hmm. I personally like. But there are also many producers that are just adding water. That's very common okay. practice where you pick ripe, you get those ripe flavors, and then you water it back to lower the alcohol, or actually removing the alcohol through processes.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. We'll talk about that sometime if I can get anyone to talk on the record. But one of the things is you can't drink as much. You get a 16% wine, and you're not going to be able to have three glasses of that.
It tends to dull your palate, I find, and more of the subtleties. I love the subtleties in wine, and for me, many of the subtleties don't show as much with higher alcohol levels. Mm-hmm. So I tend to like a little bit lighter-bodied wines. They might not have as much bang and impact on your first sip, but as you sit with that bottle, instead of getting tired the more you drink it, the more you fall in love with the bottle.
And that's really what I want from a wine. I want the last sip of the wine to be heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I don't want to think, I better finish it. I paid for it. I want to tip that glass.
Fight with the other person over who gets the last pour.
Exactly. I had a wine like that recently. I will think about that wine forever. It was absolutely, it's the kind that makes me want to fall to my knees and sob.
Yeah.
One of those absolutely gorgeous things. Well, we just have a few minutes left because we have our book review coming up. We have time for a couple more questions if you want to call 588-0637. Of course, that doesn't work if you are listening on a podcast. What haven't I asked you that I should? Is that fair?
Well, I get a lot of questions in the restaurant about local wines, and there's so many great local wines. And one of the things that's difficult is a lot of the best wines, there's great wines made in large quantities and small quantities, but there's so many real small quantity producers that you're not going to be able to find even in a retail store. They don't have open tasting rooms. So I really like to encourage people to taste some of these wines in restaurants. You can get on the mailing list of the wineries. They may even make 100 cases or 500 cases, but they can be some of the most exciting wines locally. So I definitely recommend people to try some of these small production wines that may not have a tasting room.
Mm-hmm.
Another question I always get is, well, why do you sell so many foreign wines? Why don't you just sell local wines? And it's not that I don't support the local wine industry. I love the local wines. But it's sort of like if somebody asks you the question, why don't you only listen to local music?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much variety in the world that just for me, I like to experience all of the different styles from around the world. Mm-hmm. I encourage them to drink our wines and for us to drink wines from other places.
It's a great way to travel.
It is. And it's a cultural connection.
And I know
people, there's certainly been movements towards more local produce and local products, and I certainly believe in that. But there's always room for a certain amount of cultural exchange, and I think that we really can't lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm. Albarino.
Yeah. So Albariño is a grape that's well known in the northwest of Spain and Galicia. It's also in Portugal and in Vino Verde. Typically aromatic, a lot of stone fruit flavors like peach. I always get kind of a orange rind, real zesty, floral, high tone aromatics with bright acidity. They're very refreshing. We do have some grown in California, not a lot, but there are a few Albariños.
Seguicio.
Yes,
Seguicio does one.
And the Haven's Albariño, I've had in the restaurant. But the wine is really best known in the northwest of Spain in the Rías Baixas. And those are great summer
great
wines.
Summer wines, yeah. That just popped into my head. I was thinking I'd like a glass of Albariño right now.
Some people think that Albariño may have a common lineage to Riesling. And some of those real aromatic peachy characters in the wine, I can definitely see, but they're often done in a dry style, moderate in alcohol, bright and refreshing. And they could be great. It's such a great season for tomatoes, cold tomato salad, and an Albariño certainly be real refreshing, as well as certainly seafood. Food, which is what it's probably most paired in the area.
That sounds great. And on that note, I'm going to have to say thank you.
That was so quick.
It flies by when you're having a good time on Mouthful. I hope you'll come again.
Always. Thank you for having me. And anybody has, I know people are always sometimes scared to ask some questions, but come see me out at the Farmhouse Inn. And
is that the best way to get a hold of you, is just come see you at the Farmhouse Inn?
We're always happy to have diners. So.
Okay. And you're on River Road, right near...
7 miles west of the freeway out near in Forestville. Off of River Road.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I promised that I was going to say something about the farmer's market today in Sebastopol. It was the most glorious day. The weather was perfect. It wasn't too hot. I got there at 10 o'clock. I didn't leave until 2:15. I spent the whole day there, and there was a band that replaced the band that canceled at the last minute. They're called the Don Giovannis. And I got a chair massage. I'm sitting there getting a massage. And I hear this absolutely amazing voice. And I don't know enough about male voices. He was probably a tenor. I'm going to guess he was a tenor. Singing these extraordinary Italian songs. And eventually, the whole square there in front of the stage filled up with people with their mouths open, listening to this guy belt out the most achingly romantic, passionate songs. The Don Giovannis include John Davis, who used to work here at KRCB. They've never played in public before. They didn't think that they were ready. There were other wonderful things that happened at the market today. A bunch of people sitting in Princess Aisha's booth, making music on drums from Ghana. It was just a glorious day. And I'm always telling you to go shop at the farmer's market. But sometimes take a tablecloth, buy a lunch there, take a lunch, and just spend the day. It was just one of the best days I've had in Sonoma County in a decade. And when Carlo is the singer's name, when he started singing this song, oh my goodness. And I wasn't the only one who reacted as I did. So here you go. This version of Aldi La is Emilio Pericoli. I will see you back here next week with an interview with Alice Waters. We will be recording it at the Sebastopol Farmers Market next Sunday at 11 o'clock. So you can come by, watch the interview, and go home and listen to it.
Ci sei tu, al di là del sogno più ambizioso, ci sei tu, al di là delle cose più belle, al di là delle stelle, ci sei tu. Ci sei tu per me soltanto.
I'm writing about the Bucarera. Have to sing about the Bucarera.
I was standing at the counter at my local independent bookseller, arms heavy with weighty tomes on topics like biotechnology and the decline of the world's fisheries, when I spied a little book by the cash register. It was called Don't Throw It, Grow It, 68 Windowsill Plants from Kitchen Scraps. Honestly, how could I resist? With its wacky 50s color scheme and old-fashioned illustrations, the book is a bit of a throwback. It was originally published 30 years ago by two New York gardeners, Deborah Peterson and Millicent Selsom. Millicent is now tending the great garden in the sky, but Deborah has updated this wonderful book for a new generation of cooks and gardeners. With recycling all the rage, it couldn't be timelier. Like most Americans, I had a childhood flirtation with growing things in jars on my mother's kitchen windowsill, sweet potatoes and avocados mostly. Last year, I got a first-hand demonstration of how kitchen scraps find new life when I dumped our not-quite-fully-recycled compost in our garden and a few months later got an unexpected crop of potatoes, squash, pumpkins, tomatoes, even a watermelon, reborn from the scraps I had thrown into the compost a year before. When Peterson and Selsom wrote the first edition of Don't Throw It, Grow It in the mid-70s, they had to scour the ethnic markets of New York City to find enough different kinds of produce to fill their little book. All that has changed. Plants that were once considered exotic, like kiwi, papaya, mango, and jicama, are now sold year-round at most supermarkets. The first part of the book is a primer on getting plants to grow from seeds or cuttings. The rest is organized by variety. For each vegetable, fruit, or spice, the authors give a short, easy-to-follow description of how you grow it from the product you buy in the supermarket, a brief history of the plant's origins, a description of what the plant looks like, and which parts are edible. I'm really eager to try my hand at growing ginger. Like iris, ginger is a rhizome. In 6 weeks, it will produce a 3-foot-high stand of greenery that looks like bamboo. And did you know that you could grow a pineapple plant from that thorny crown of leaves you usually toss away? Who knew? I have a few small quibbles with the book, of course. As gardeners, the authors were really more interested in growing plants than eating them. So much of the book is devoted to what the plant looks like or how decorative the flowers are. Also, because the authors live in New York apartments, there's not much guidance about how to naturalize these plants in the out-of-doors, which anyone in more moderate climes will surely want to do. That being said, the book is a kick and a perfect reminder that the food we eat is really part of an eternal cycle. So like the authors say, don't throw it, grow it. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful. Support for Mouthful on KRCB comes from KRCB radio members and from the Sebastopol Farmers Market, now open in the downtown Sebastopol Plaza every Sunday from 10 to 1:30 with organic, sustainable, locally produced fruits, vegetables, meats, and cheeses, plus breakfast, lunch, and local musicians. Support also comes from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the rustic Italian tradition, featuring seasonally sourced organic produce. Serving brunch Saturday and Sunday, Peter Lowell's Cafe online at peterlowells.com. Support also comes from NetBooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by phone at 86-NETBOOKS. Listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some flip cornbread. Listen to what the preacher says. To the Lord that praises me. It's time for dinner now, let's go. Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.